When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. Today we're talking to Dr. Hugh Bennett, a reader in international relations at Cardiff University, where his research focuses on the experiences of the British Army since 1945. And somewhat related to that, we're talking about his new book with Cambridge University Press, Uncivil War, The British Army and the Troubles, 1966 to 1975. Dr. Bennett, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Aidan. Great to be with you today.
So maybe we could start just with the question that I think seems to be almost prompted by your title. Was the Troubles a civil war? And if it was, why don't we just call it that?
Yeah, this was something that troubled officials and military officers and politicians a great deal in the early days of the conflict and also for years afterwards. There was certainly a reluctance, a really deep reluctance within the British government to ever call this a war, you know, and still, you know, of course, the euphemisms abound, the troubles or the conflict or the difficulties or whatever people may call it, because it was something that the British government didn't want attention focused upon, especially at places like the United Nations or in the emerging what's now the European Union, or elsewhere diplomatically. So they were quite keen to minimise the difficulties, which is a long-running kind of theme in the wars of decolonisation as well. And they also didn't want to give credibility to the IRA by accepting that there was a war going on and admitting that the IRA might have some kind of standing as an army as opposed to terrorists.
And so what do you see it as? Like, do you see it as a civil war? Are you happy just calling it the Troubles and leaving it at that?
Yeah, I'm very non-committal on it. So my view is that within a couple of years of the conflict starting or re-emerging rather in the late 60s, early 70s, that the British government had become very obsessed about preventing a civil war. And that, if you like, this obsession with trying to contain the conflict and limit it in its scope is more important than deciding whether it actually was a civil war or not. So there's lots of debates, especially amongst political scientists, about what is a civil war. You know, what's the definition of it? What's the threshold of violence? Does it have to be 1,000 violent deaths per year? Can it be fewer deaths than that? Does there have to be some kind of international diplomatic recognition of the warring parties? So there's all these kind of definitional debates about what it is. And my view is that's up to the reader to decide for themselves what they think about it. And I take the bit of a kind of cop-out position of saying it's more the debate about it at the time that's really interesting.
Sure, fair enough. You mentioned there that there are certain aspects of Northern Ireland and of what happens in Northern Ireland that bear comparison to other wars of decolonization. And in your book, you talk quite directly about certain kinds of baggage that soldiers bring with them as they arrive in Northern Ireland. And I assume some of that is baggage related to coming from other wars of decolonization. So maybe you could talk us through that. What is the baggage that they're bringing with them?
I mean, what I started off trying to do in the book was to push back at this idea that there was a lot of baggage and trying to give us a slightly more balanced interpretation of how much baggage there was and what was the nature of the baggage, because there'd been a real tendency building up over a couple of decades for academic studies, especially in military history, in strategic studies, to try to explain everything with reference to decolonization and to say, look, what happened in Northern Ireland in this period, it's just the same kind of problems, the same types of violence and military tactics that had been used in Malaya and Kenya and Cyprus and various other places. And what I was trying to show is that there are large parts of the violence in Northern Ireland and significant kind of aspects of the conflict that just don't make sense with this colonial kind of rubric around it. So there's unmistakable aspects of British conduct in Northern Ireland that are colonial, and probably the most obvious standout ones are interrogation in depth, or, you know, we could just call it torture, the use of internment without trial, so detaining people without any kind of judicial process, but just on really on suspicion, and searches, the wide-scale use of military searches, having a kind of very disruptive effect upon civilian communities. So there are unmistakable pieces of baggage that you can see. These things were done in the colonies, and then they were done in Northern Ireland as well. So you can't really refute that. But there's also significant colonial practices that were really not applied in Northern Ireland. So there were no free fire zones, for example, right? So there were in Kenya, for example, there were prohibited areas where the military could just open fire on anyone who was there. Now, there were some politicians who were calling for that in Northern Ireland, but it was never formally approved as a policy. Another big one, of course, is the use of in Malaya and Kenya of what at the time was called villagization, but what now we would probably call kind of forced population transfer, very close control of people's living conditions, forcing out them out of their homes, out of their ancestral lands, into very closely monitored and quite nastily repressive living conditions in many circumstances. So that was not done in Northern Ireland, and that was a major feature of many of the colonial decolonizations. So I'm trying to kind of, in the book, accept that there were these aspects of continuity from the colonies, but also look at some of the significant differences too. The other, if I can, like the last big problem I had with this idea of like colonial continuity or baggage really is politically and morally, what it does is it makes the senior military officers and it makes the senior politicians, the cabinet ministers and so on, it makes them into kind of unthinking robots who just have this toolkit of, okay, so there's a problem like this, we just apply these tools as we did in the past. So in a way, it kind of removes responsibility from them, and it denies the fact that they debated and discussed and in some cases agonized about what to do in Northern Ireland. So they did use repression in Northern Ireland, but it wasn't unthinking repression. They decided to use impression very deliberately.
Mm-hmm. And maybe if I could switch away from, let's say, looking at Northern Ireland in this much bigger, or maybe trying to shoehorn it into this much bigger colonial context, if we could look at it in the longer context of Anglo-Irish relations, what kind of perceptions did soldiers bring with them about Irish people? And do they just see Northern Irish Protestants as just being another kind of Irish people, or do they have an understanding that they bring with them of the differences between Northern Irish Catholics and Northern Irish Protestants?
I think there's a real split here between different parts of the army, different levels of the army, and also with the civilian leadership, the ministers and the civil servants back in London. So at that kind of top leadership level, there is an awareness of Anglo-Irish history, and there is a sort of almost fatalistic view that whatever Britain does in Ireland, it's going to lead to disaster. Like that this is a very unhappy history. And this is something that very much concerns the Labour government in the 1960s. And if we're trying to understand why would the troops sent in August 1969, why were they not sent in earlier, when there were some people calling for them to be sent in earlier to support the police and stop things really deteriorating at that point. One of the major reasons is because the British cabinet had this very fatalistic view that whatever Britain does in Ireland is kind of guaranteed to go wrong because of this complicated and tangled history. So there's that going on at a senior level. Then you've got parts of the army that are quite familiar with Ireland. So let's not forget, of course, that there are regiments of the British Army that recruit in Ireland, right? And even after partition, they're still recruiting from the south as well. They're still recruiting people from the Republic. So there are those parts of the army that have a pretty sophisticated understanding of the kind of emerging politics of what's going on in Northern Ireland in the 60s with the political upheaval. But then when you're talking about the majority of the British Army and normal soldiers, regular soldiers, you know, privates and sergeants and kind of quite junior people, most of them have absolutely no idea what to expect. So you have these accounts of soldiers going over to Northern Ireland in August 69 and in the months that follow, who are kind of astounded that this place looks just like Birmingham, or it looks just like London. You know, the street signs are the same and the road layout is all familiar, the same kinds of shops and so on. So they can't quite make sense of it because it's alien and very, very familiar all at the same time. I think there's real difficulty amongst ordinary soldiers in figuring out the politics of what's going on. That changes over time. And of course, by 1972, 1973 onwards, you've got professional soldiers going back to Northern Ireland every year, every 2 years, perhaps even more frequently than that. You know, people who serve in the army for a 20-odd year career, they will go to Northern Ireland maybe 6 or 7 or 8 times. So in that longer term setting, soldiers do develop a much kind of deeper understanding of place.
And there is this thing that in hindsight can look quite odd, that there's almost like a honeymoon period for the army when they do come in. They're somewhat welcomed even by the Catholic community. And yet then it all starts to go wrong. So what exactly went wrong?
This is the big question, and this is where there's still going to be debate and disagreement on this issue for a long time. And I think, you know, the simple answers are either, well, it was all brought crashing down because the army couldn't help itself; it just reverted to the colonial mindset and did its colonial thing and started being repressive again. And the alternative explanation is, well, everything was fine, and then the Provisional IRA was created in December 1969, January 1970, and the conflict really started and became much more violent because of the Provisional IRA. So those are the kind of seductive, nice, easy answers. And the messy answer that I think is more convincing is that it's something to do with both of those things. But thrown into the mix, of course, something that's often missed out, because there's often such an emphasis on the IRA as the kind of the pivotal actor in the conflict, is the role of the loyalist paramilitaries or the kind of Protestant extremist groups as well. So the real kind of, I think, the turning point is around Easter 1970, where the Provisional IRA is becoming more militant and more active. It's starting to organise rioting against the British Army and against the police in a much more kind of worrying way than ad hoc, you know, random riots that are just kind of quite chaotic. This is much more focused and managed. But at that time, the assessments from the army and from the police are saying that the greatest danger actually comes from the loyalist paramilitaries and not from the IRA, right? So they've got a decision to make. Are they going to try and deal with the loyalist paramilitaries? Are they going to try and deal with the IRA? Or are they going to try and deal with both of them at the same time? Up until that point, the policy had been to deal with all of them at the same time. But from around about March, April 1970, the army instead decides to, if you like, launch a pretty concerted preemptive attack on the Provisional IRA. So the view is that the loyalists are more dangerous, but in order to stop the loyalists from killing lots of people, you should remove the thing that is provoking the loyalists from wanting to kill lots of people, which is the IRA. So it's a calculated risk, and there is a clear awareness at the time that it's a calculated risk and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So you're obviously paying very, very careful and close attention to these shifts in policy, in mindset and thinking. What then changes when Edward Heath is elected Prime Minister? Does that cause a change in how the army is acting?
I argue that the shift had happened in those few months before Heath came to power. So Heath was elected in June 1970, but so I'm arguing that the change really happened around the March, April time. And the way that I'm able to make this argument is, as you say, the archives that I look at, if you like, are from the top level and from the bottom level. So what's generally missing in the archive record is the stuff in the middle, which is headquarters Northern Ireland. So the generals in charge in Northern Ireland and the brigades. So there's an army brigade in charge of Belfast. There's another in charge of the west of Northern Ireland. A third one later comes in. Their records are mostly missing, but you can work out what's going on from looking at the papers at the top kind of British cabinet level and then at the low level British Army regiment kind of level and see the connection between the two and the communication going kind of up and down that chain of command. And so it's quite clear to me that the change in the army's operational style certainly happens before Heath comes to power. Now, why have we not noticed this before? So on the one hand, we haven't noticed this before because nobody else has gone through the archives like that to check, right? So that's the first reason. But the second reason is because the Labour government, who are overseeing this change earlier on, are not broadcasting it from the, you know, they're keeping pretty quiet about it because it's not consistent with their political position, which is that there should be reconciliation and a negotiated settlement. So they're not really open and honest about it. And by contrast, when the Conservative government come in, you know, this is the party of law and order and so on, they're much happier using this kind of tougher, more disciplinarian rhetoric in public and in parliaments and else and in the media and so on. So it's understandable that people have kind of looked at that rhetorical shift and thought, therefore the practice must be perfectly in alignment with the rhetoric. But of course, rhetoric and reality don't always match up perfectly with each other.
And just before we move on, could I ask a clarifying question? When you say the records are missing, what does that mean?
So they're missing from the National Archives. So they're missing from public scrutiny. They're not missing completely. So there's, you know, to use the horrible kind of Rumsfeld phrase, there's definitely known unknowns, right? So when I started this book project, I did a survey of everything that was kept in the National Archives on the catalogue. And I had two documents. And the one document was the open file, all the documents that were available. And the other document was the closed files. So things that are listed as being there, but you're just not allowed to look at them for another 50 years or maybe even 100 years. And occasionally, through using the Freedom of Information Act or just the natural process within government departments, things shifted from one document to the other and they became open. So there's a vast amount that's still classified, like these brigade records, that the headquarters Northern Ireland records. And of course, perhaps one of the biggest collections of all are the collections of the intelligence services. So MI5, the UK Domestic Intelligence Agency, absolutely none of their records on Northern Ireland are open at all. They were active in Northern Ireland in this period. So this is a major organisation that was kind of party to the conflict, and we've got almost no idea what they were doing. Apart from, you know, some journalistic works and things like that. So there's things that we know exists, but are not available yet. And then there's probably the unknown unknowns that we could add to that as well.
Sure. So it's all very fascinating. So maybe we could go back to this question of how and why things go wrong for the army or risks they take that then kind of blow up in their face. There is something of a perception that maybe by the mid-70s or certainly by the end of the 70s, the IRA is trapped in a kind of a cul-de-sac where it is strong enough to be a military presence or a paramilitary presence, but not strong enough to actually force the British to back down. And so they end up in a kind of a long war that they know they can't win. Mm-hmm. Does the army end up in a similar kind of trap that they know they can't win and yet they're stuck?
Yes, they're both in the same position fighting against each other, and neither of them can get out of it. Now, there are some in the army who are perfectly willing to admit that. And there are some civilians in the Ministry of Defence, civil servants, who are also willing to admit that and advise the government that the only way out of this is some major political negotiation and reform that is very likely going to require cooperation with the Irish government. It cannot be done as a unilateral kind of British initiative. It has to be internationalised. And there are other parts of the army who are some senior generals who are absolutely adamant that they will beat the IRA if only they're given more time, if only they're given more money, more resources, more soldiers, more equipment, and so on. So I think that probably also kind of mirrors the debate that ends up going on within the provisional IRA. You know, you get the kind of the militants who think that they can coerce the other side into giving up everything that they want, and there are others who are much more skeptical about that. So you get the kind of the diplomats versus the militants in both the British state and in the IRA. By actually, I mean, I would say even earlier, maybe 1973, 74, you already start to see these kind of cracks emerging on both sides.
And then just as a kind of a final question, I mean, when I look at, say, your broader work as a historian, you're obviously looking at this much more as a kind of a British imperial scholar rather than an Irish studies scholar, right? You've written on Yemen, you've written on Kenya. When you look at Northern Ireland somewhat from the outside in, what do you think still needs to be done? Like, where do you think new research needs to be carried out to further understand the Troubles?
Well, that's a great question. That's a tricky one. I mean, the first thing I want to say about that is that as an outsider, if you like, coming in, it's been a really wonderful experience and one where I've been helped by so many Irish historians and scholars of the conflict, working in different disciplines as well, you know, beyond history too. And, you know, you can't always take that for granted that that'll happen. So I've been helped a great deal by people being really generous. I think that, you know, in terms of the dynamics of the conflict itself, the biggest misunderstood and the most poorly understood of the combatants is certainly the loyalist groups, right? So even if we're talking about the biggest of them, like the Ulster Defence Association, which has, you know, 10 or 20,000 members at peak, it's big. This is a significant militant organization that can really have a very serious effect upon the dynamic of the conflict. So, like, there is no really authoritative single study of the Ulster Defence Association, right? And, you know, there are much smaller groups like the Down Orange Volunteers, more kind of regionally based groups, which are also very significant, and little is known about them. So I think that's one of the biggest gaps at the moment. And then, you know, you can certainly say that there are whole other kind of more thematic approaches that could be taken to the conflict, like gender history. There's a lot more that could be done on the experience of women in the conflict, of children in the conflict as well, the history of trauma and of the kind of mental health consequences of the conflict. There's massive amounts more to be written on the Northern Ireland Troubles.
Well, thanks so much for this great conversation. As I think all this shows, like, this is a very careful and sophisticated book and makes a very valuable contribution to a still somewhat misunderstood part of the world. Thanks so much, Dr. Bennett.
Thanks so much, Aidan. Cheers.